I was on the admissions committee and we wouldn't let you in here unless you were an offensive lineman. That was my own personal project. But, let me do that, I got a few words more. But, don't expect in 1 year, or 2 years, or 3 years, or 4 years, to have it well enough so that you're anything, as long as you're conscious that you're apprentices, we can live together. But not to the extent where you expect me to really take you seriously. Then I say, okay, we're playing fun and games again. I've said my say.
Well, I think...
That ought to get a discussion going.
Yeah, that's good. That's great. I wasn't trying to say that people should be out there just expressing their feelings to one another. I think what I was trying to say is, you know, all of us have our little bit of knowledge that we can put in that 2 pages. And I think a good way to better understand how you think is to see how others think, you know, to express your own thoughts. And, you know, in that dialogue, that you can, you know, increase your knowledge.
Oh, I've got no quarrel with that. Just don't expect me to take it seriously as a political movement. If it's self-education, I think that's great.
Well, that's...
I think that's fine. These are called bull sessions, and I think the bull session is an extraordinarily good way to get educated. But let's remember that it's a bull session and leave it at that. And don't tear the university down, which is what happened when it got out of hand in 65.
I think the students, I mean, are far from that at this point. I mean, I don't think that would be...
I agree. It's one reason I like you people better than I like David.
Yes.
Okay, all right. What you just said made me a little bit mad.
Good.
I definitely agree with you. Sometimes I have a lot of very strong feelings, and I feel that I really don't know enough to back up what I'm saying, and I think I'm here to learn.
Right.
But then again, I sit down and I think, and I say, how many people who are running the government, how many people who are in positions of authority and power in our society really know enough about the American government, really have enough insight or depth to see? I probably totally disagree with you because I think that the current administration doesn't really have, I don't really think, or any administration, I guess, whether a conservative administration like the Reagan administration or a liberal administration, I don't really think that people in positions of power have enough knowledge. So I think that a lot of how people act has to be predicated first on how they feel. I think that people should act out of knowledge. It just seems that if we just accept what's told to us by people that might not have as much knowledge.
Okay. I never suggested that. I mean, I never suggested that you sit there placidly taking notes. I mean, I want you to use your heads. That's what you got heads for. But my God, you want people to act the way they feel? Shall we all stand up? I mean, well, you know, let me give you a recent example that I grew up with that bothers me a lot. It's called Nazi Germany. That's how they acted. That's the way they felt. 100,000 idiots in a stadium all going Sieg Heil. They were not critically examining the speech, all right? They were feeling very intently. Feelings, well, let me tell you a story, which will illustrate this, I think, very well. A number of years ago, my younger son and I were going down Seneca Street. So most of you heard this story because I put it in a notorious note-taking lecture, and if you heard that, you heard the story there, but it's worth repeating. And there was a car in front of us with a bumper sticker on it, which said, if it feels good, do it. Now, that's a moral system. That's exactly what you're saying, you see? Your feelings are your guide to moral action, and if you feel that this is right, then it is right. So my son, who was at that point going through the throes of adolescence, Oedipal complex, and all of this kind of thing, said, Dad, why don't we cut him off, pull him out of the car, beat the hell out of him, and then at the end I'll say, boy, Dad, didn't that feel good, and we'll have a philosophical discussion. Okay? No, it's a perfectly legitimate way to go about it. Why is it not, why is that not absolutely appropriate? If I feel good oppressing someone, why don't I follow my feelings? And a lot of people who feel good.
Yeah, but that's not what she's saying. That's
well, she's saying her feelings are benevolent. That's what she says.
People desire, what I desired when I started into this business of trying to change the world, or at least some parts of it was, to understand in the process why people who seemed good when I was a kid before I could think particularly well, not that I can.
I was going to say, there were those of us named
who seemed to be destroying whole populations of innocent women and children, etc. And now it's still going on, and you don't need to be possessed by a PhD or of a PhD or even a master's. researchers to see, say, in the Harvard Medical Bulletin, how infant mortality rates in the black communities in Boston are skyrocketing now that the Reagan administration has cut off aid for families and dependent children, now that certain prenatal care clinics have been closed down. So you can make a deduction. You can say something could be done about this, should be done about this, possibly. Maybe it's not good that that many more black children are dying than white children. There's a discrepancy here. Can't we bring them both down? How to do it, admittedly. Now that's complex. But one of the reasons why it's not being done may be because nobody started when they could take the kind of buffetings that someone gets when you try to do good in a community that's oppressed.
Gee, you know, David, let me give you another example, which occurred after World War II, where I signed all the shipping slips for this. And I was in the South Pacific. We wiped out insects because we don't like insects when we fight, especially mosquitoes that carry malaria. So we shipped tons of DDT to the South Pacific. And the war ended, and we had, you know, millions of gallons of DDT sitting in the South Pacific. What to do with it? Well, you don't want to ship it back to the United States because it'll knock the bottom out of the DDT market in the United States, among other things, plus it's a long haul. So somebody came up with a very bright idea. Let's wipe out malaria in Ceylon, okay? A lot of children die of malaria in Ceylon. Same thing. A lot of infant mortality.
But not as
Wait. All right, I agree that the culprit here was not Reagan, it was mosquitoes. Okay?
Well,
it wasn't politics. No, but if you're going to follow your feeling, I mean, all of us said you would not be. What a wonderful thing. We're great, us Americans. By God. You know, nobody else would have thought of this.
That's the trouble. You're simple trying
to. Ah, right. No. But we did it. And we increased the infant mortality rate because the kids are now dying of starvation. Okay? In 10 years, the infant mortality rate was higher than when they were dying of malaria, plus the fact that Ceylonese society had no social instruments by which they could handle starving children, whereas they had lived with malaria for 2,000 years. And we screwed it up. All right? I'm sorry, all I'm saying is here were good feelings, moral feelings, and they led to disaster. And
the civil rights movement, though.
Huh?
The civil rights
movement. Well, wait, the civil rights.
Good feelings.
Sure. The civil rights movement was based on justice. Civil rights movement was based upon the United States Constitution. That's what it was based upon.
The United States Constitution existed long before.
That's right, until people began to argue that the 14th Amendment means what it now means. But remember, it was not civil disobedience. Martin Luther King did not break the law. It is the point. He insisted that the laws apply to blacks as well as the whites.
To get activated and energized, and get emotional about that blowing up churches down in the South was the wrong thing to be happening.
I'm not arguing that you shouldn't do something, but that was not the result of vague feelings.
It provided some of the fuel,
David, but the civil rights movement was in many ways a very coolly intellectual movement, beautifully orchestrated by Martin Luther King, who knew exactly what he was doing intellectually and did it well. It's a model of what you want to do.
But in that initial stage, remember they played the
Of course.
I
agree. That's fine.
Feel like they're tired, and maybe they come up with the right one every now and then. Us. You know, I mean, I still feel like I'm senior year.
Well, I do too. It's been a long senior year. Yeah.
I just want to say, you said exactly that you had this excess DDT stuff, and here the feelings could come along, you could plug the morals onto it. What do we do with this stuff? We have to dump it. How convenient. There's bugs here. We'll dump it. We'll say that we're helping people. There wasn't this bunch of GIs running around saying, oh my God, look at the starving kids. What are we going to do? Let's give up our spray repellent and get rid of the malaria so that these kids could survive. It was just a nice, convenient way to do something with that. And I think there's a really big difference there. And I think that is a big point, too, about a lot of a lot of what you are upset about with a lot of the policy, social policy, that seems like it creates more problems than it was a feel-good thing. Who knows how much of it was started because someone felt like doing something and did it, and when it needed to be done for economic reasons or leftover DDT packages lying around, and then it felt good or it was the right moral thing to do that's connected with it. And so then I just don't at all see that the malaria thing.
All right, well, how are you going to keep your morals pure? How are you going to keep it from being connected with economic convenience and economic self-interest and turning into a boondoggle which will benefit the bureaucrats who run the system that is supposed to help people.
Well, how should you do it to benefit the bureaucrats?
No, how are you going to keep them from getting their noses in the trough? That's how, I mean, you're talking about Reagan. That's what Reagan is objecting to.
Objecting to what?
Objecting to the fact that many of these programs benefit the people who run the program more than the people for whom they're intended. And that what he wants to do is therefore withdraw the federal monies and turn it into a local thing that can be more locally policed. You agree with that or not?
I don't agree that that's what he is really. I think that's what he said he's doing.
Oh, but you know what he means.
I disagree. No. He's pumping the money into the military and increasing that at the cost of everything, because that suffers from equal and more problems. And I really think that if we don't get involved in some way through the system, and even if we do have to deal with a lot of corruption and we ourselves have to compromise in some extent, I think it's still necessary we do it.
Well, I'm not arguing with you. What I'm saying is, for God's sake, know what you're doing before you get into it. And don't go into it just on the sense that you feel something is wrong. That's why I asked you the question, what do you understand about the way the system works? How can you fix it if you don't know how it runs?
I don't think we're arguing that point.
Oh, the feeling point we're arguing.
I don't think that thinking can exist without feeling.
I agree.
Thinking first starts with a feeling. So you have to have a feeling. You have to deal with that feeling and then think out your feelings in order to come up with very intellectual thought and intellectual policy and U.S. Constitution.
I don't think you can separate them. I'll go back to what you originally said. You say, well, you're arguing that the feeling is prior to the thinking. And I'm not sure that the feeling is prior to the thinking. I think the feeling and the thinking may very well go hand in hand. That I don't think you start out with a feeling and then rationalize it, which is what it seems to me you're saying. But that the two go together to enable you to detect areas where you think something might be done to make the world a better place to live in. But I think the thinking element is extraordinarily important here, and it's not just enough to feel strongly about something. I mean, that's romanticism, and it's deadly.
But you need both.
You need both, I agree, yes. Oh, quite. I mean, I hope I'm not giving the picture here of a dispassionate, dry intellectual who doesn't get involved. I mean, my blood pressure must have hit 220 here a couple of times. I mean, I do feel. I feel very strongly. But I think you have to think. And you have to be very careful with your feelings, because one of the things that feelings do for you, they're very good at deceiving you. Self-deception is the easiest thing in the world to rationalize, to do, end up doing precisely what you want to do and working out a good reason for doing it. You know, again, if I may give you William's Easy Guide to Moral Action, when you want to throw up, you're probably doing the right thing. And when you feel good about it, you're probably doing the wrong thing. It's not a bad little gauge. When you find yourself taking action where you wish you were someplace else, then you're probably really doing what you ought to do, because you ought to do it or you wouldn't be there. Your feelings would take you out of there. And when you're patting yourself on the back for being a great humanitarian, the chances are you're probably being a rat. And it's hiding an awful lot of selfish motives. Now, this is autobiographical, so maybe I should.
Why don't you go ahead? Yeah, you with the blue sweatshirt.
I'm curious as to when you think somebody has the proper knowledge to act,
Oh, well, I think that's an easy one. You don't have to have total knowledge. I mean, I'm not suggesting that we all be Hamlet.
Because you
mentioned that. Or Tevye, on the one hand, on the other hand. No, I think there is a point. You know, for example, when I have a problem with my automobile, the point at which I feel I can act is when I understand the machinery well enough to be able to diagnose the problem and take a look at it. I may be wrong. But if I don't know how an automobile works at all, I'm a damn fool if I say, geez, I think that's the clutch, if I don't even know what a clutch is. So, I mean, I don't think there's any problem here. One can gain, I mean, I hope one gets better. I quite agree with you. I don't think there's anybody capable of running a government, or we'd have a philosopher king. But I think people do have different levels of capability. And that, take a guy like Barbara Conable. How many people know who Barbara Conable is? Well, see, that's a disgrace in a political situation. And Barbara Conable is probably one of the wisest representatives that sat in the House of Representatives in the last 50, 100 years. And he's right up here outside Rochester. It's not as though he's from, from Mars. But this is a guy who has a very good idea. He's smart. He's sensitive. He's a politician, which is not always a swear word. He understands how the system works. He understands perfectly well how to get certain things done. He's been very effective. And I think he's a, Conable, I can't vote for him. But Conable is the kind of person I would certainly choose as my representative if I could. I have Lundin. Well, since you don't know who Conable is, I hope you don't know who Lundin is. But he's a schmuck. Is this, well, it's taped anyhow. He can't sue me because he's a famous figure. He can't be libeled. But that's the kind of thing I mean. These are people of relative competency, but the relative competency is very visible. And I think you ought to try for increasing competency. And see, I can argue against that.
Scan the black sweatshirt. Yeah, you had your hand up before.
Oh, just two questions about simple answers, part three, actually.
Try one.
Please let me ask you before any answers come out.
You answer them.
This is for Pierce.
Oh, nice try, Pierce.
In what sense is the slogan America's Back any deeper than the slogan Power to the People? And another question, how many pages in a notebook do you think Ronald Reagan could fill with his thoughts on America? The stage you have to reach before you're able and competent to deal with something, has Ronald Reagan, who knows probably less history than half the people in the room, I would say, competent to do that? And in what sense?
What makes you think I'm for Reagan? What makes you think I'm for Reagan? You're simply assuming it.
You can find all your criticism of slogans and simple answers to answers on the left.
Oh, well, I'll take answers on the right. Reagan is, first of all, not a conservative, and I am. Reagan is a right-wing radical. You know, he's an 18th century liberal. Take your choice. Well, they're both the same. William F. Buckley is a right-wing radical or an 18th century liberal. So is Barry Goldwater. Unfortunately, I am the only conservative of my type that I've ever met. And so, you know, but I'm a powerful party of one. No, everything you said, I absolutely agree with. I think the slogan is a slogan, and it's a bumper sticker. Or better yet, it should go on the back of a horse. I quite agree. Reagan hasn't, the intellectual power, I suspect, of anybody in this room. And he knows very little. Now, he has one good thing going for him that you can't ignore, and that is his ability. I'm not sure what he communicates, but he communicates. And when you get large numbers of urban workers voting for Reagan, you've got to ask yourself the question, why? I don't know why, but he must have something there that he's selling them. So I know, I have no problem with that question. I think you're absolutely right.
I have difficulty with what you're saying, because I don't see how you can tell us not to be active. We're trying to learn how to be active. You want us to develop, and so we can learn how the country runs, how the country works, how maybe we can help run the country. We can't test our strengths as we're going through college. What is the point where you want us to be able to speak? When will you let us speak?
Well, let me give you an analogous situation. Some of you will end up being wheelers and dealers on the stock market. Surely you would not argue that we ought to provide you with funds in the sophomore year to play the stock market. On the principle that you don't know anything about stocks, probably, and that you will blow it. I'm not sure that's true, incidentally, because nobody seems to know anything about stocks. I don't see, I'm not suggesting that you not be politically interested. I'm not suggesting that you not even organize with political interests. I would rather have the goal of your political organization be self-instruction and mutual instruction than at sophomore, junior, or senior level, or whatever level in college, that it be immediate political impact on a society about which you know very little. I mean, the way you learn about politics is to learn about it, and there's one good way is to go into it. I mean, the real way to get politically active is to run for public office, or to work for somebody who is running for political office and learn the ropes that way. That'll teach you something. I'm not sure it's enough, but it'll teach you something. But the way not to do it is to get together, I mean, we were talking here about 20 years ago, not to get together on college campuses, which are very delicate organisms, and use the power of bumper stickers to organize students in such a way that one threatens the existence of the entire institution, which is the institution that's feeding you.
Is it Jan? Yeah. Let me just read one quote quick, and then you can answer your question, and then you can be next. I figure it would be interesting to see if anybody recognizes this Professor Williams may have been at the talk, I think you were, but you may not remember this particular one. I've always liked the Peanuts cartoon that shows Charlie Brown writing a letter to the editor. I think, quote, "It is time for all of us to be more positive. We must stop allowing others to speak for us. Each of us needs to stand up and be counted. Sincerely, name withheld." Now, the comment then is very interesting. There is a message in that cartoon. Thou shalt not stand idly by. Commitment does not come easily. It means that we have to squander ourselves for wise and noble ends.
Don Quixote.
That's very good. Do you know who's that? Do you recognize this? This is our commander-in-chief at Cornell. This is a quote from President Rhodes' commencement speech to graduating seniors last June 1984. It's a wonderful speech. In fact, the last two were fascinating. The first and the one the year before, he quoted Nikita Khrushchev and Pope John the 23rd about the diametrically opposed perspectives. What would be the last piece of advice? Khrushchev said, "Never turn your back on anyone." And Pope John said, "Never refuse an outstretched hand." Now, why I cite these things is partly because what we're dealing with here, interestingly enough, at this institution is a fascinating polarity where Professor Williams will come on very strong about staying out of the fray until he's sure you know something. And then he'll test you, get your papers, you can get in. I'm exaggerating. Here's President Rhodes saying, squander yourself. Don't stand idly by. Of course, he's saying it to seniors. It's a little safer because they'll be leaving.
That's right.
But keep that in mind, you know, because this institution is so multifaceted that you can find support for virtually, unfortunately, almost any perspective that's on the boards these days. But I'll turn it back to you two gentlemen and then keep the questions going.
A question on what seems to be a contradiction in yourself in just the turn of 15 or 20 minutes when Mark first talked about what he wanted to do and get groups organized and just talk between them, and you still on for a while and then basically said, "Well, I'd like to hear you all shut up." And then you just now turn and say that the way to get politically active is to get organized and have mutual education. Did you just turn around and say no to something you said yes before? I
mean, no.
It seems that he was suggesting get some organization, get some communication, because the one way to learn is to talk it out. Maybe when you talk idiot to idiot, you don't get anywhere, but sometimes an idiot has a good suggestion, and then you go from there, and perhaps with people like yourself helping us along instead of saying, shut up until you know what you're talking about, we could learn a little bit through discussion, as opposed to just taking notes.
Well, I mean, again, the university is a place for intellectual exploration, for all, and one learns incredible things outside classrooms. And so on. What I was objecting to, I didn't think it was a contradiction. If instead of your major purpose, you simply want to discuss politics, which one can do without knowing very much, I mean, it happens all the time, then I think it's a dead end and a waste of time. And all you're doing is trading, again, feelings. I feel this way, you feel that way. Why do you feel this way? I feel this way because of that. You'll find out an awful lot about how other people feel, but I'm not sure you're going to find out much about politics. What I'm suggesting is that there are ways in which you can learn about politics and about political systems, and particularly the American system, not just in classrooms, but by an actual participation. Take a term off and do something, run for office, or work with some kind of civic organization, or get into a bureaucratic organization and see how it runs. If that's what you, I mean, if you're that interested, and then you've got something to contribute. But I think if you just keep batting back and forth on the same level, I don't see that anybody learns anything. It just seems to me to be a waste of time. And I don't know why you want to do it. I mean, there's an awful lot to learn in this world. I don't see why you would want to waste it just sort of in yelling at each other, which is what's or talking with each other or talking past each other.
Yelling at each other, because guys from the outside, for people who do know what.
Well, I mean, we try to do this. We call them seminars. You know, that's exactly what we try to do when we try to teach politics and political things. But many of you haven't got time for this. I mean, engineers don't have much time to take in humanities. Many of the humanists are not so concerned with learning about politics. They're more interested in poetry. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. Those are also romantics. You keep giving me romantics. And I'm trying to fight romanticism because I think it's essentially a dead end.
Well, what you said during the Vietnam War, when people feared war being killed, people were more justified in being active on campus and tossing these ideas around. They could care if not for having college.
There were very few ideas tossed around during the Vietnam War. They were mostly, again, the ideas were wrong, let's get out. I don't consider that an idea.
I thought that it wasn't a declared war and that two-thirds of the Senate are supposed to be.
All right, that's an idea. That there was very little political action behind that movement. Very few people wanted to put that, bring any political pressure to push that. There were no suits filed in federal courts to declare the war unconstitutional. There was no political action at all, really.
What did you think?
Thank you. There were a hell of a lot of teachings, ideas. George T. Cann,
Jesus Christ,
one of our
Douglas
leading
Dowd
experts,
yeah.
Douglas, you know, and John Lewis, who worked with Navy intelligence prior to coming to academia, where he taught course on Chinese foreign policy, wrote one of the seminal studies on the U.S. involvement in Vietnam from pre-1945 on. We read those books, we talked with those professors, we had late night rap sessions with each other, and sometimes even with them. We had time after time, Bailey Hall was filled with debates, I mean, for debates and with debates. Sometimes it wouldn't be just on the stage. So Pierce is, again, despite my respect for him, somewhat simplifying the situation. I'm afraid that this dichotomy between the discussion sessions, that working out of feelings amongst peers or whomever you can get together, and the seminar is a false dichotomy in the context in which we exist. Because what goes on in a seminar, if it's carried over into the living room, the lounge, or God forbid for some of us, the Royal Palms, or wherever you might go and have a beer, it can have a meaningful effect for the rest of your life. I was a product earlier of the ILR school. It's known, anybody who studies labor union history, very, very effective union organizing often took place in the bars. It was the only place accessible to these guys in the early stages. Not to make it sound like it's the best place to go, but when you're with your peers, you can work things out in one way. You do need help from people who've been around longer and know more, and you can get it here. It's a kind of a combination that people have to strive for. But if you keep going to authority figures for the sources of data, information, historical perspective, and psychological profundity, you're going to run into trouble, because pretty soon you realize that there are very shallow spots in a lot of the supposed geniuses around here. And believe me, we've dealt with them.
No problem.
On the Committee on Education in the Community. Huh? I mean, let's face it.
Yeah, but I have no problem with any of that. I mean, again, David says exactly what I think I've been saying, which is, I'm not saying education takes place only in the classroom, but I am saying that the classroom is a very good source for starting it. And if you don't start it there, and if you just sort of wrap around among people who are equally ignorant, I don't think you're going
to
go anywhere.
Thank God. I was wondering when we'd get out of here.
Yeah.
A constant lament of people who are active in student groups on campus and students who aren't is that the campus is very apathetic, that students don't get involved in campus affairs and national affairs. People just sort of go through their daily lives. I would think you would like that state of affairs. That's just about the way you want things to be. Students should just let the world go on as it is until they're ready to get involved. The question is, do you approve of that state of affairs? And this is a question for Dan Burak too, because I would think that he would have a different perspective on students being apathetic. And what should be done about student apathy, if anything?
Well, as I tried to suggest at the beginning of my talk, I would rather replace apathy with thoughtfulness. And if you look at it that way, the question assumes a different dimension. That is, if you run your life, you know, everybody's got his own rights here, and you don't have to, you can run it your way. I like to try and run my life in terms of looking very, very carefully at problems that I feel are problems with which I should become involved. And before I do anything, before I invest a lot of time and effort, I would like to have a pretty good grasp of it. And during the time I am getting the grasp, now I don't think I'm apathetic, I'm working. I am spending a lot of time and effort on some of these things. When I think I have a glimmering of what I'd like to do and why I'd like to do it and how the thing works, then I take action. I don't see anything wrong with that model. I honestly don't. And it seems to me very difficult to defend what may be just the polar opposite. There may be obviously be many, many different models in between. But let me take the polar opposite just to contrast it, to defend the model which suggests that you ought to get actively involved in problems which you don't really understand beyond the surface, that you don't like it, that you think something is wrong, and that it's a gut feeling, if you will. And therefore, somebody says, we've got a group here to wipe out whatever the gut feeling is that you want to apply to it, or, you know, wipe out whatever causes that, and that you do it without any preparation except the preparation of feeling that you're doing the right thing. I don't find that to be very noble. I don't find that to be that's squandering yourself. I don't agree with Rhodes on this. I think that really is squandering. You're wasting your time. I think you're wasting other people's time. And I just find, you know, if that's apathy, to avoid that, then I'll take apathy. But I would rather have it considered as people thinking through the problems and then trying to take action on the basis of what they've thought through.
Let me try to answer in a similar tone. It's strange because I think this is one of the more difficult things for me to respond to, because I agree with Pierce. Again, you can come next, Kelly. But the point in my case is only slightly different. And it's partly prompted by the fact that I personally experienced the downward spiral into psychosis and other related maladies of the mind, heart, soul, that peers of mine, friends, people in the movement and Students for Democratic Society, people that I referred to, the Weathermen and such, which some of you may be familiar with, who studied the 60s or had older brothers or sisters, people who took a violent path, who advocated terrorism, who advocated bombing police stations or military installations to even up the score in some kind of bizarre form of metaphor that made no sense to the soul, but they thought made eminent sense, and they took it upon themselves to condemn most of the people that didn't go the path they did. These were people who were sensitive, who were decent, intelligent, who were motivated by many of the same concerns that Mark or myself or possibly you, Kelly, or whomever else is here that wants to help change the world for the better had. But they got so overwhelmed by the problems. Who do I think of? People like Kathy Wilkerson and Diana Elton, who were both killed in the town. Diana was killed in the townhouse bombing down there in the West Village. Weathermen got themselves blown up. And she's from a blue chip family. You know, great grandfather, grandfather, founder, Boy Scouts of America. One of her lamentations when she was a little girl walking home in the biography is, why are we so rich? Why are we so different from other people? Goes to Peace Corps, goes to Guatemala, sees peasants being beaten by their owners and gets the owners of the farms they work on, like owners, like slaves, and gets crazy. So I'm saying this because it's true that when you don't have an understanding of what you're getting into, you can be destructive of the very same principles and goals that you're trying to achieve. So it's dangerous. So I'm not so put off or upset by what appears to be apathy. Also, I don't think it's apathy either. I think it's an understandable reaction to an overreaction of the previous decade. I've taught writing from experience about a dozen times in a few other writing courses, including creative. And I see the stories that freshmen write or upperclassmen, the creative writing pieces, poems, and there's concern, there's sensitivity. It just doesn't always matter. It doesn't manifest itself in political activism of the old kind. But that's not altogether unhealthy. I much prefer people to be cautious now, because one of the things that destroyed the movement, both sides too, the civil rights movement that were led by black people that turned toward violence, like some of the Panther tendencies, some of the Muslim internal fighting that had Malcolm X executed, assassinated, killed, call it what you will. These all were emanations of a lack of understanding of what was involved. And I've been through it once. And it scared me, it scarred me, it concerns me today. So people are well advised by Pierce's admonition to go slow. I mean, we don't always agree, but on that one, it makes sense.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I guess, clearly you said a lot about what I just wanted to say. Being involved now in trying to do student activism, I sort of have a reaction to this word apathy that's thrown around. And I do know, being in and out of university, being in the workplace, in the university, also grading journals as a TA, I know that there is sensitivity, and I know that people are thinking. I think there is activity apathy in people who are thinking, as Professor Williams is saying, and I also will go right along and say that there's a lot of thinking apathy or lack of mental activity in a lot of people who are acting because there is that, I am at least doing something. And I think that is sort of a big question. I know that in fact just being taking on a big role as trying to when you get a moral conviction or whatever to make some action, you can lose track of all of how you're feeling in your position. And one thing that I really want to challenge is that the people who are thinking and trying to figure it out don't think that you have to know everything, because that I think can lead to psychosis. I think that there's a mixture between the two. And another question, since this is ending, I just want to mention there's going to be kind of a continuation of this on Saturday. There's a workshop, conference at Moore Hall, if anyone wants to come up for information. But there's one workshop title that I want to use for you guys here. It's called Hierarchy in the Classroom, Young People's Oppression. How do the internalized messages we receive as children, i.e. that we are powerless, insignificant, or silly, show up in the classroom? So start that one first.
All right, I guess we're going to close this. Thank you for coming to the Browsing Library discussion, hour and a half. And it takes place every week. 2 weeks after break, we're going to have Professor Kramnik and Dan Hauser here to have a discussion on the conservative, Michael Millett in the paper put it out, that students here are convinced to be liberals as they go through Cornell University, since we have an inherent liberal bias. We need to get more conservatives there. Professor Kramnik and Dan Hauser have something to say about that. And I'd like as well, if groups, political groups, would like to get in touch with me.
Anyone.
Or anyone would like to get in touch with me. I would like to continue our discussion at whatever level in some kind of formal basis and make this some kind of institution at Cornell that takes place on bi-weekly, however it works out. But I'd like to hear from people.
Next week there will be a social hour. The topic, I'm ambivalent to say because I'm not exactly positive on what it is. It has to do with the educational system at Cornell. If you have ideas for other topics you would like to see discussed, come and tell me, and I'll get people to talk about it.
Sure.